Well, hello and welcome to episode 86 of the Payers and Players podcast. My name is Robert. I'm here with Scott. We've got an awesome guest, but before we get to that guest, if you would take a second to go follow us on Twitter, you can search at Payers Players. Once you follow, if you feel so inclined, we'd love you to also subscribe. It helps us to bring all this awesome content each week or each month, kind of however often that we bring it. So, Scott, do you want to introduce our guest today?
Yeah, I'm super excited to have our guest today. Met him a few years ago at Western and Southern and have really been wanting to have him on the podcast for a while. And I'm finally going to make it happen. Guest is Harry Jaden, the head coach at Michigan State University. Harry was a walk-on at Michigan State, and after that, he became an All-American at Michigan State. And now he's the head coach. So not many players have that kind of trajectory, and I think he's got Michigan State going in the right direction. They're probably as good as they've ever been, and we're really excited to have Harry on to talk about his journey and the Michigan State program.
Yeah, absolutely, guys. Thanks for having me. And yeah, I'd say my journey is not a testament to me, but probably a testament to my predecessor, Gene Orlando, for putting up with me each day and, yeah, dragging me each and every day in order to be the player that I became by the end of my career. So, yeah, it was a fun journey, and obviously this place is a very special place to me.
Well, and speaking of journey, before we get into it, want to make everyone out there aware of a great documentary called Jaden's Journey. And if you want to check that out, that's a really good story on Harry's life and how he got to Michigan State and some of the struggles he had to deal with as a young player and how he overcame them and became the player and coach that he is today. So highly recommend that. I know, Robert, you watched it last night. What did you think?
Yeah, I'm happy you asked. Scott had been pushing me for a while to watch it, and it was one of those, like, every time he'd send it, I'd be in the car and I'd just forget. Mm-hmm. So finally last night we're talking, he says, hey, go watch it. So I show it with my son, Everett. You met Everett at the ITA, and my wife, Sarah. And all I'll say is people better get their Kleenex ready, because it's a good one. I can't remember. There was a saying back in the day, if you can laugh and cry and struggle all in one day, you've lived your life to the fullest for that day. Well, this one's going to make you do the cry part. So it's really good. If you get a chance to watch it, it's outstanding. And was that done by like a student organization or a group of? Go ahead.
It was pretty crazy. So I worked at the this was when I was in college. I was not going to be a college tennis coach. You could not even convince me after my 4 years of playing I was going to be done. So I actually worked at the radio station at Michigan State, the student radio station. And one of the guys there who did a lot of video for the radio station was applying for jobs, and he had found that, like, you got to have work, you got to have a portfolio. And so he kind of just asked around, and he heard a little bit about my story with my mom. To make the listeners familiar, she was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's when I was in high school, and it progressed, and she actually passed away my senior year of college. And so he heard that story, and he said, hey, would you like to do something? And obviously, I thought it would be great. And yeah, so it was just a student who was dang good, and he's gone on, obviously, to do some great things. So I definitely owe a lot to them. So, yeah.
Yeah. And that's you can find that on YouTube, and we will put a link to it in the show notes, and we'll put it on Twitter when we release the podcast.
Yeah, and no spoiler, this isn't a spoiler what I'm going to say, but one of my favorite parts of it is as you see the players in there talk about it, and they describe that final match as like the best experience in their life in tennis. And you start to realize, I think there's a lot of folks out there that if players aren't playing in the U.S. Open, then it's like, you know, we only care about like the top five players in the world. But to have an experience like that, you start realizing how much tennis affects players across all levels. So I highly recommend it. It's totally free on YouTube. Go check it out.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, with that, you know, for the people that have not seen it, can you give us a little bit of your background and how you got to Michigan State?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in East Lansing, and my parents had met. My dad was from Pakistan. My mom was from Midland, Michigan, and they met going to Michigan State. They were both civil engineers. They were in the engineering school here. My dad came from Pakistan, which was obviously a much longer trip than Midland, Michigan. But they met there, and after they graduated, they really liked the location, and they settled down in East Lansing. So I grew up here. I was a townie, as we call them now, on campus. And you know, I just grew up going to football games, going to basketball games. I mean, when we won the national championship in 2000 in basketball, there were, you know, it wasn't in my neighborhood, but I could hear the ruckus and the noise, and you know, fans burning couches and things like that, which MSU is pretty legendary for when our football or basketball teams do some big things. And so I grew up a Spartan fan, and quite honestly, like now that I look back on it, as I aged into high school and got to the recruiting age, I mean, I like shouldn't have ever ended up at Michigan State. I think as me as coach now, I probably wouldn't have even recruited myself, you know, when I was coming into college. But you know, Gene Orlando, who I played for, was my predecessor here as the head coach. He put a premium on taking local kids who had a bit of the chip on their shoulder and who really worked hard, and that's what I was. I mean, when I enrolled at Michigan State, I'm going to digress. I'm going to backtrack a little bit here. But when I enrolled at Michigan State, I was really supposed to be just kind of a glue guy, work hard every day, get good grades, keep the team GPA up a little bit. At the time, I didn't think of myself in that. I thought I was going to be a legit player. I was going to be a contributor, even though I was a walk-on. I was like, I'm good enough. I'm good enough. I'm good enough. And one of the reasons why is because, you know, a few of the schools were recruiting me were Michigan State, Western Michigan, obviously being local. Kalamazoo College was another one. My brother played at Kalamazoo College, and then Illinois. And so Brad Dancer, who obviously I worked for a brief amount of time, and he's a great mentor to me to this day. He would come and watch me practice, and I was like, "Yeah, Illinois wants me." And at that time, I mean, still now, they're one of the premier programs in the nation. And I thought, "Yeah, that makes sense. Illinois wants to come watch me." And it wasn't until I was coaching now, and I see how much a head coach travels for recruiting and competition and stuff like that. Brad is from East Lansing, just outside, 5 minutes away. And so my theory is, and then when you guys have him on the podcast, make sure to grill him on this. But Brad essentially was recruiting me because he could come to the athletic club, watch for an hour or two, but then he gets a free trip home where he can say he's recruiting, he can spend time with his family. And so I put the pieces together probably halfway through college or as I became a coach. And you know, I thought that was pretty funny. And I don't blame him. I'd probably do the same thing too. So I you know, I walk on to Michigan State and play some doubles. I was a serve and volley, used the Prince Graphite racket in the, you know, 2010. So that's like 20 years after that racket had ran its course. But, you know, for a serve and volley, that racket, I mean, money with volleys. And so I creeped my way into the singles lineup as well my sophomore year and junior year. And by the end of my career, I was playing one doubles and three singles. So I had a pretty good development and trajectory, which you spoke about. And you know, my best day of tennis was one of my last. I mean, when I got All American, and I tell my guys this all the time, it's like you don't know when your journey is just going to take a sharp turn and go up, because you know, I didn't get All American status until the second last day I was playing college tennis. I mean, I grinded, I grinded, I grinded. We were ranked in doubles, but we were ranked around 20th in the NCAA tournament. We had to get to the quarterfinals to get All-American status, and we did. And so, you know, for my guys, I always tell them, like, hey, I know you might not have gotten the results you wanted up to this point, but all it takes is two special weekends or one special week, and all of a sudden you realize your goals. So that's a little of my story. After I graduated, I worked with the USTA player development a little bit, coached at a local hotbed for recruits here in Michigan as well, and just kind of got interested in coaching because of that working. I was honestly looking to make some beer money and, you know, have some fun with my buddies after I graduated. Your typical tennis story where you continue to coach, but you know, ended up really taking a liking to it. And Coach Orlando called me in 2017, said his assistant coach left, and you know, I ended up taking the job as assistant coach and really, really loved it. So here I am.
Scott, do you care if I dive into two quick questions here?
Go.
So Harry, tell me this. So two things from the documentary that were interesting to me. The first was your journey or your transformation as a player from a headspace perspective, right? Going from a player that was kind of volatile on the court, and even in the documentary, they mentioned that that was one of the reasons they didn't recruit you was they saw the behavior on court, and then the transformation to less volatility on the court. And Scott and I have this conversation a lot because you go to a junior tennis tournament And the folks that are volatile are usually also the most competitive. So it's a double-edged sword. But what would you say to, say, a 10, 11, a 12-year-old who is also that volatile, and what you learned from it? But also, what would you say to their parent? Like, okay, parent, because I've had a few parents, hey, my kid won't behave. And, you know, that's a discussion. So how does the behavior volatility as a player, what's some advice you have? And then also for the parents of those children.
So I'll preface this by saying that this information doesn't come from me. I have a secret weapon in my coaching methods, and that's my wife, who's a school psychologist. And I pick her brain a ton. And I've talked to her about this exact topic. And, you know, one thing she always reminds me of, even with the guys on my team, I mean, a person's brain is not, the research is starting to come out now, and the date keeps getting pushed further and further back. But as of right now, research shows a person's brain is not developed until they're 27, 28 years old. And the last part of the brain to develop is the frontal lobe, which controls your emotion regulation, your decision making. And, you know, you put these 11, 12 year olds in situations where there's pressure on them. They're obviously competitive. They want to win. They don't know how to handle those situations. And I think with a parent, I think the biggest thing is get to the why, as to why they're reacting in that way. And sometimes those whys aren't bad things. I mean, a lot of times kids get frustrated because they really, really want to win. And so that's where I think a lot of work goes into, you know, focusing on the process rather than the result. And I think a lot of your language as a parent and a coach really, really matter, where you're prioritizing their process and you focus on things they control rather than the result. Because, you know, if you do everything right, you can still lose a match. You know, you might be playing against a really good player. You play the best match of your life and you still lose 2-2. So I think really being process based, and I think just being patient with kids and allowing them to mature, and then just setting clear, unemotional boundaries, where I feel like a lot of parents, you know, you can't fight fire with fire. So I think a lot of parents fall into the trap where their kid's yelling, and then the kid gets in the car and the parent yells at them. And I fall into that trap as a coach as well. And my wife always says, hey, at worst, as a coach, the only thing you need to do is model behavior. And if you're getting mad at them for getting mad, it's the same thing they're doing. They see a problem, they get frustrated. You see a problem, you get frustrated. And it's really important that you're very clear with your boundaries. You make sure it's not emotion-based and it's just very, very calm and communicated to them beforehand. And it's not reactive, but proactive. I think that's the best way to manage it. And, you know, I talk to my guys a lot about, you know, their thermometer on the court. And where do they want their thermometer? Do they want it at 100 degrees running hot and just feisty? We have a guy named Ozan Barış who gets pretty hot on the court. And then, you know, other guys, our Greek player, Aris Thanos, do we want him probably around like a 30 degrees? We want him a little chilly and calm, almost, you know, Federer-esque, you know, when you compare him to Nadal. But yeah, we want him a little bit more relaxed, laid back, because if he gets worked up, some things start to go wrong and it's not good mentally. So, you know, just different ways to address it there. But just having conversations is the most important thing, I think.
Yeah. So what I hear you, though, the main theme is be patient, right? As a parent, as a coach, you know, we did an episode, our third episode, if people haven't heard it, the title of it was, do we expect our 10-year-olds to behave like a 35-year-old Roger Federer, right? So the wonder I have is, so you talk about parents, you talk about players. How do you think the tournament organizations need to maybe adjust, the referees, the tournament director? You know, Scott and I could tell you numerous stories about our own children. And so do you think the tournament should adjust any to adapt for the fact that that brain development isn't complete?
Yeah, I mean, I think just a lot of more, I mean, and a lot of this falls on the referees, honestly, a lot of management and a lot of, you know, just having conversations, even if it's a training on how to manage, you know, young kids, because it is kind of crazy that we have the same penalty structure for a 10-year-old as we do a professional player, at least with the USTA or a college player.
Well, I mean, it's actually more strict for a 10-year-old than it is for an ATP player.
Right. And I think that's kind of crazy. But yeah. I think just the soft skills of managing those situations, and we've had some refs that have done a really good job in the past year or so of, you know, managing, because college tennis, I mean, if you're calling everything that should be a point penalty in college tennis, I don't think anybody on the court in a dual match, you know, rivalry dual match, I don't think anybody on the court is finishing the match because there's a lot of things going on and maybe the refs don't hear it, but you kind of have to manage it, you know, and I think the refs that are really good are the ones that are able to, you know, communicate what the boundaries are and be fair on both sides and make sure that they're being, you know, professional and not reacting to what the players are doing.
Yeah. One thing I want to be clear, I'm not condoning poor behavior, right? But I've also never talked to a parent whose player was behaving poorly that wasn't totally embarrassed and wanted it to stop, right? Mm-hmm. Every parent, they don't want their child, as I tell mine all the time, as long as you have good attitude and good effort, I'm fine, but don't embarrass me, right? And he's embarrassed me many times. That I think a little empathy from the parents too is important. When a kid's out there doing that, instead of, you know, you hear this statement often, well, if my kid did that, I would be blah, blah. Everybody doesn't realize what's going on with that child and why they might be exploding or might be volatile like they are. So just a little compassion from also the parents and the crowd would be a good thing. So let me dive into also your dad. So one of the things I love in the documentary is the environment he attempted to create at the matches. And so Scott and I talk a lot about, I mean, it drives me crazy when I watch the U.S. Open and somebody gets up to walk and the whole stadium stops and waits on that person to sit down. I think that's ridiculous. Like, you know, what other sport do you go, even golf, there's people moving around the whole time and making noise. So tell us a little bit about your dad and the environment he was able to create at the Michigan State matches, because I absolutely loved it.
Yeah. So my dad was, you know, obviously a huge fan, and he managed it well from a parent's perspective. He was really cheering on the team. He was never overbearing or really, like, you know, I feel like a lot of parents want it more than their kids. I mean, he did a great job from me, kind of like letting me do my thing. He never got involved, especially as I got into college. But from the team perspective, he would show up on match day. He'd get the crowd rowdy. He's a very, very outgoing man. And, you know, it created a really good atmosphere. I don't know that the other coaches on the other teams enjoyed it. He got into some verbal fighting matches with some coaches in the Big Ten for sure. But, you know, it's who he is. I mean, he's outgoing. I don't know if you know his story, but right now he souped up a 4Runner, and this is his retirement project, Toyota 4Runner. It has a tent on it, on the ceiling of it. It has a fridge. It has a stove. It has pressurized water and a shower, all in his Toyota 4Runner. And he's driving from Michigan all the way to Chile. He's in Honduras right now. He left last year in October, almost a year into his trip. And then he's going to ship his car over to Africa, go to Cape Town, and drive all the way up to Cairo, Egypt. So he's crazy. He's a certified crazy person. But that's his retirement plan. And he's just going from place to place. He's by himself, meeting people and having a blast. And that's the type of person he is. And so you get him in a college atmosphere, he got rowdy. He got rowdy, and it was a lot of fun. And honestly, I think college tennis needs more of that.
I couldn't agree more. And that was you can tell from the documentary, he's an immediately likable person. Like, you can't not like him, right? But the other thing is that's what I kept saying, is I wish we had more of that. But I think one of the funny scenes is when he first started it, you're like, Dad, stop, as any kid would do with their parent. But then he says, but all the other players said they liked it, so I kept doing it.
Yeah, and like, that's how it goes with him. I mean, this whole, to compare it to the trip, obviously he's already driven through Mexico. He's driven through El Salvador, Belize, a bunch of countries in Central America. And when he planned this trip, we said, Dad, stop. Like, you don't need to do this. You can go take a flight somewhere, stay at a resort. But he is stubborn. When he sets his mind on something, he's going to do it. And he did the same thing with college tennis. So it was a blast. It was a lot of fun, and created a great home court advantage for us.
Yeah. So will he be back for the spring season?
He's not coming back for – I don't know if he's ever coming back, because he's about a year in. And if you look on a map and you see how far Michigan is from Honduras and compare how far Honduras is to the southern tip of South America, he's got a long ways to go. So I don't know when he's coming back, but you know, if we have a big time match on campus, if we're hosting NCAAs, I might play for the flight ticket, get him back here, and you know, get loud.
You guys need him there for sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, so hey, we got into a little bit of your background, and you know, one of the things that I was curious about was, and you guys hit on it a little bit, but maybe you could talk to a little bit more about, you know, how does your experience as that sort of player that may have not been, you know, so appealing to watch in terms of, you know, the emotions, how does that inform your recruiting? You know, I've listened to some coaches and they say, oh, if I see a kid throw a racket, he's off the list. You know, if he does this, he's off the list. This is, I mean, if that's your standard, then Federer is off your list. I've seen Federer do the same thing. So how what do you see, you know, in terms of, you know, how do you see those kind of kids as a potential recruit?
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest thing, and I talked about it earlier, is like, you got to figure out the why. I mean, is he throwing his racket because he's given up and he's done with tennis, which a lot of kids, that's why they act that way on the court. Or is he throwing the racket because he wants to execute on a short ball, you know, short forehand, and he misses it three times in a row and he's completely frustrated and doesn't know what to do. So I think, you know, for me, being one of those guys, I always am willing to take a look. No, we aren't, like, you asked me, are we crossing you off our list because you're passionate about tennis? We're not going to do that. And quite frankly, we're not in a position to do that. So, you know, maybe some other programs who are a little more established, I'd say, we're kind of on the upswing, but they could probably do that because they probably have three or four players on their list that they can kind of go down and check. But you know, we're gonna do our homework. We're gonna make sure it's happening for the right reasons, if that makes sense. And then when they get on campus, we obviously have a great, you know, sports psychologist department here at Michigan State, and we're gonna do everything in our power. I mean, that's one thing that I tell every single player I talk to in recruiting is like, I can't fail. This is my first job as head coach. I'm in my second year. If I can't get it going now, I'm in deep trouble. And so if I can't fail, you can't fail either. I'm going to pull out everything I can in my coaching bag of tricks, and my assistant coaches and, you know, the staff here at Michigan State, we're going to go the extra mile for you. And that's kind of how I feel about it. And some players are just one, you know, coach or one meeting with the sports psychologist away from putting it together. And I know that's how I was. And credit to a guy named Matt Roberts, who's coaching at Mississippi State. I threw my racket. And maybe my first practice or second practice at Michigan State, he looked at me dead in the eye and said, you do that again, you will never play for us. And that's what I needed to see and hear. And that worked for me. So I think that, you know, giving those guys a chance, and if you manage them the right way and handle it, they can really, really be an asset to you.
Yeah, we know Matt well. He's a good guy. So I'm not surprised that he had a high standard, but he also had a little patience. So that's good to hear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so talk a little bit about your team there at Michigan State. You know, you reference, you know, some of your assistant coaches, the sports psychologist. What, I mean, obviously Michigan State has all the resources in the world, but how does that help the tennis team?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the coaches that have coached at Michigan State, I'll kind of name a few. Brad Dancer, who's now coaching at Illinois, he was an assistant coach. Matt Roberts, now head coach at Mississippi State. There's another guy, Damien Hume, who's the assistant coach at Princeton, doing a heck of a job up at Princeton. And I had, you know, probably three or four assistant coaches in my time here. And it was awesome. Like, just going from a guy like Matt Roberts to a guy like Ryan Young, who went on to be the assistant coach at South Carolina and Clemson, to Damien Hume. Like, it was really cool to get different, like, coaches' insights into the game. In terms of our sports psychology, we had a guy named Dr. Larry Lauer, who was with our program when I was playing, and he was planted on my court every single match, because I didn't really need coaching in tennis. I needed to get my head straight while I was out on the court. So he's now the lead sports psychologist with the USTA, and does a great job, and we stay in touch to this day. But yeah, I mean, at Michigan State, we have two full-time assistant coaches. I know a lot of programs weren't able to fund the second assistant coaching position, so that's been huge. My assistant, Mike, is doing a great job, and second assistant, Kazuki, who just graduated last year, has been unbelievable and doing a really good job with the guys, and we kind of each check off our own boxes. We work well together, and then, yeah, I think it's, I don't know, it's kind of frustrating, honestly. I just played college tennis 5 years too early because these guys – I mean, they're getting, you know, fueling station. They get snacks, protein shakes, smoothies. Today, I went to their fueling station. They had overnight oats that were made for them. They go after a workout. They get all that stuff. And then they got the sports psychologist. We have two athletic trainers that can just take care of your body, three coaches. I mean, man, we're flying out to San Francisco to play tournaments in Tulsa. And I remember one year we went to Milwaukee. No shade to Milwaukee, but we went to Milwaukee in March, and that was our big spring break trip. And everybody was excited about it. And now it's like if we went to Milwaukee, I think the transfer portal would be lighting up with players from Michigan State because, you know, it's expected that you go somewhere that's pretty cool. You play three competitive matches on spring break or whatever it is. And yeah, it's pretty cool to see the resources that are getting into college tennis, and it really shapes our recruiting pitch and shapes the level of player that we can bring into college tennis now. So it's really, really exciting.
All right. So one of the things I wondered as I watched the information in the documentary was I wonder how many players are out there on teams that are like you, right? So I see a lot of players that 11 and a half UTR range, and I don't know what your UTR was when you entered, and I don't even know if it was accurate back then, but you got these 11 and a half UTRs that go to Big Five or Power Five schools, and they either play hit and miss some here and there or not at all. And I wondered watching yours was it that you were just a diamond in the rough that they missed? Or do you think that your hard work and dedication is what made you get to a point of one doubles, three singles? What? So in other words, if there's an 11 and a half out there that's playing at, say, Mississippi State or Ole Miss, and they hear this, how much can they actually get better in college if they enter at that 11 and a half range?
I think you look at a lot of the players across the nation. I mean, there's definitely it's not the rule, it's definitely the exception for a player to develop in that way. And I just think if you do that, if you go to a program where you're outside of the lineup looking in a Power Five conference and you're an 11 and a half UTR, your Y better be strong. Your Y better be freaking rock solid because you know you're gonna train your tail off. Those guys who are at eight, nine singles, they're doing the workouts every morning, they're doing the sprints. They're getting, you know, hollered at if they're not running their hardest. They're going through, you know, all the practices, the gut checks, the two-on-ones. And at the end of the day, you got to ask yourself, why am I doing this? And if a kid's doing it, and this is what we have to watch out for recruiting is like, if the kid's doing it for the gear and to tell people and his friends that he's a member of the Michigan State tennis team and he's a Division One athlete, that ain't gonna cut it. Like you're not gonna get better. You're gonna check out because you're doing all that hard work. You're not playing on match day, and you know other guys are competing ahead of you. And I just feel like if you have a why that's stronger, and my why, quite frankly, is in that documentary. My mom was passing away, and I wanted to make sure that I had this opportunity, and she got to see me, you know, empty the tank and really develop and make something special out of my 4 years at Michigan State. And that's what kept me going. And I think that that's a question that's so hard to really analyze in the recruiting process because you really got to get to know a guy and get to know why they're doing it in order to see if, hey, are they going to stick it out their freshman year when they're playing eight singles and you know, they get to play against the second matches of double headers every once in a while and they're traveling and on match day they're not getting the reps that everybody else is getting. And that's a question that I think great coaches have found the answer to.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I mean, and go ahead, Scott.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say it makes sense, and I see it happen often. And very, very seldom do I see your story. The rule, like you said, is more they show up, they don't get to play, they either quit or they hang on the team for a few years and have a good experience, but never really get into the lineup or play that second match of the day, like you mentioned. So. When I saw your story, it really intrigued me. I wonder how many other players are out there that if they would just buckle down and work really, really hard, could they raise their level? So I appreciate that answer.
And I also think, you know, to add on to that, by no means was it hard work and dedication. I mean, it's a combination of a lot of factors, but I also think, you know, the coaching, and I had great coaches, the coaching goes a long way. You got to have guys that are, you know, steering you in the right direction, kind of navigating you through the tough situations that come up in college in general, as an 18 to 21 year old kid. I think that's really important. So your relationship with the coach also has to be really, really rock solid.
And so, I mean, and that worked out great for you because, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, you being from East Lansing, you knew the coaching staff, you knew Gene for years. And so, you know, they could be honest with you and you knew what it sort of take and you could take it from them. Whereas if you say, let's say you went to, you know, Texas or somewhere, maybe you don't have that same relationship and you don't take the coaching the same way. And so that's probably helped a lot.
Man, if I was at Texas playing for Ryan Lippmann, I would be 10 times the player I am today. That guy's good. He did a great job at Tulsa and All-Americans. He's a good friend.
Well, hey, so I want to talk a little bit more about sort of your recruiting process. And, you know, when we initially did this, we're going to do this podcast, it's going to be in June, and, you know, now we're in October. But one of the questions I had at the time was, you know, that was the time, the period, I guess, when you can start talking to rising juniors. And so I'm curious, you know, from scratch, how do you guys come up with your list of players you want to contact, and how do you go about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I listened to Roditi's podcast, obviously, and I think he was spot on. I mean, we get so many emails from players saying, hey, I'm a 12-1, but I'm playing like a 12-5. And Roditi's, he has a way of putting things that make a lot of sense. And it's like, no, you're a 12-1. And you must be playing a 12-5 on some days, but you must be playing an 11-7 on other days. So obviously we use UTR, ITF rankings. We'll see, you know, WTN as it becomes more accurate. I'm guessing it will factor into the conversation as well. And then it's like eye test, meeting with them. You know, I've put a lot of miles on my frequent flyer account. And then also just word of mouth. You know, we have some players that have played at a high level in juniors and professional tournaments. So there's many names that they know. So we'll ask them, hey, do you know this kid? What do you think about his game? Would he be a good fit? Da 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 da. And from that point on, it's really just reaching out to the kid, communicating with them. And I would just say no recruiting process is the same. I mean, it's crazy. Everyone is completely different. And that makes my job fun. Sometimes it causes a lot of lost sleep, but it's you got to be creative. You got to reach the kids, you know, by tailoring your message and making sure that you're hitting the right points and addressing the needs that they have. You know, some kids, they might be really focused on what does a practice look like. Other kids are, hey, you know, do you have the facilities and resources to make it happen? And yeah, all those things kind of factor into it. But just to start really looking at results and then diving into, okay, why is this kid getting those results? Or maybe he's getting these results and he could be better. What's going on there? All that good stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense. And when you think about the recruiting, it also, if it's a 14 UTR, the approach is probably a little different than if they're an 11 and a half, right? So yep. The 14s are probably being pursued and the 11 and a halves are having to do the pursuing. And that's just the nature of the beast, right? But when you talk about the scholarship money, can you kind of talk about how many scholarships you get and how you strategically use that? And you know, you may not want to say too much, but I'm curious on how that works.
No, I'll break it down. I mean, every the NCAA limit on scholarships for college tennis is 4.5, and we have a full allotment of 4.5. And so tennis is a sport where it's not like basketball. Basketball it's a head count sport is what they call it. So you either get a full scholarship or you don't. So our 4.5 scholarships is a full 4.5 scholarships, but we can break it up in any way, shape or form. If somebody's a stud and we want to bring them in, we can offer them 1.0 scholarship, a full scholarship. We could also offer them 25%, 0.25. And so you got to be, you know, smart about how you're managing your 4.5. But also I think there are a lot of factors, in college athletics now that are helping, a full scholarship now. I'll just speak in general terms here. It covers your room and board. It covers your tuition and fees. So that's what you would think of as a full scholarship. But now with legislation and the NCAA kind of being sued and da-da-da-da-da, there's actually a $4,000 or $5,000, depending when you're living, where you're living. It's called cost of attendance. And that's to cover flights or, you know, clothing or gas or food, whatever it is that comes up. So if somebody's getting a full scholarship, they're getting over their tuition in room and board. And then another legislation was Alston money. And now schools have the option, if they have the funding, that everybody who's on a scholarship, or they can set it up as they please, can get Alston money, which is another $6,000 on top of the full scholarship and $4,000. So there's wiggle room with how you can manage it. I find that to be one of the most fun parts of the job. I like being creative and crunching numbers and explaining, you know, why you know, it makes sense for a kid to come to Michigan State, and maybe they're paying more than if they go to a different school. But that investment that you're investing in your education, you're investing that in your tennis game. We're going to have, hopefully, ideally, better practices. We're going to have better facilities. We're going to, you know, hopefully have better, you know, results and training and all that good stuff. So explaining to players that as well is really, really important.
Yeah. So tell me this, how much does it, because you think about it, if every player gets 50%, that's 9 players at 50%. So, yep. And obviously if a player's a 13.7 UTR from Italy, they're mm-hmm. not going to probably come for 50%. So they're going to need a little bigger allotment. So how much does the academic piece make? So I guess what I'm asking is, let's say a player comes in, good ACT score, good SAT score, good grade point average, and they can get 50% of it paid for in academic scholarships. And then you only have to commit the other 50% out of your budget. Does that equate into your calculus, or does it matter?
Yep. No, that helps out a lot. I mean, if a kid's a really good student, they do have the opportunities to get academic scholarship and stuff like that. So that obviously helps cover the gaps, you know. So yeah, definitely good opportunities there. And yeah, I mean, Robert, we got to speak off this call, because if you do have some 13.75s, man, you got to fork over those names. We need a few of those guys. That would be awesome.
Yeah, that for sure, for yeah. sure. And I think it's important for parents to know, you know, the coaches are trying to win. Nobody wants yep. to win more than the head coach. And so if their child, and I had a college coach say this to me one time, 11 and a half are a dime a dozen when you start recruiting in D1 Power 5, right? And so the parents just have to understand that if your child, an 11 and a half is a really good player, but if that's what your child is, then they're going to have to bring some type of an intangible, like great grades, so they can get other scholars, because they're more of a project for you than that 13 and a half. Would you agree with that?
For sure. I mean, I compare it to finding a date at the prom. You know, everybody goes through it in high school where they're searching around for a date. And, you know, for me, you could go ask a girl that you know is going to say yes, or you could approach a girl like my wife who is going to need some convincing, and you're going to have to really lay out all your chips on the table to hopefully get her to go to the prom with you. And that's kind of how it goes. And sometimes, you know, and obviously we've been on the butt end of this, is some of the top dogs have taken their pick of the litter. You know, sometimes it doesn't work out in the way that you want, for sure.
Well, I like this. You give us dating advice, where Didi was giving dating advice. So, you know, this is the Love Connection Coaches Edition.
Yeah.
Hey, just wanted to clarify a couple of things on the scholarships. One, for women, it's a different scenario. I think it's 8 full scholarships. And is that a headcount situation, or can they divide those up?
No, that's a headcount situation. So so women's side is different. And, you know, my women's coach and I kind of debate back and forth whether it's a good thing that they're different or not. But yeah, they have 8 full scholarships. And on the women's side, you're either getting a full scholarship, which includes those things that I talked about, the cost of attendance on top. And, you know, at a school like Michigan State, you're getting the Alston money. So actually, a full scholarship is going to be considerably more than what it actually costs to go there. So, I mean, it's a different ball game, obviously. On the woman's side, but yeah, 8 full scholarships, and it's all or nothing there.
Great. And players that take the fall off, do those guys count towards the scholarship number, or do they, how does that work? And I don't think that you guys have any players that took the fall off, but I know some schools have had players take the fall off and they come back in the spring. How does that affect the 4.5 number?
Yeah. So you'll see, you know, a lot of coaches, again, how you manage your 4.5, you got to be creative, because you want to have as many great players on your team as possible. So, you know, if a player does take the fall off, you know, let's say he's on 100%. Well, if he takes the fall off, he'd still get 100% scholarship. Like, he would still have that full ride for the spring semester before your 4.5 scholarships. It would only count for half of that. So it would count for 0.5, 50%. So it's kind of, everything's divided in two if they take a semester off, because they're only attending for half the year.
Yeah, that helps out a lot, I'm sure.
For sure. We didn't have any situations like that, but you know, you can definitely see a lot of coaches in college getting creative with that and using it to their advantage and the players' advantages as well, because the players can go play pro tournaments. They don't have to be on campus taking classes. And I'm really interested to see, does that trend still happen? Because next year, individual championships, NCAAs, is going to be in the fall. So does it make sense for a kid to take off the fall if he's not going to be able to play the individual championships and he's going to miss all those opportunities for ranked wins and this and that to get the ATP wild cards in the spring, because it's year-end rankings that count for that accelerator program. So the fall is really big in that.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, like you say, then the wild card associated with the winning the NCAAs for the American players. So there's a lot more incentive for, you know, the Ozons than maybe there are for the Draxels kind of thing.
Yep, for sure.
And then for the transfer portal, you know, you guys, probably no program this year has done better than you guys did. You got Ronnie Holman and Sebastian Collard. I think they're probably the two highest rated players in the portal. Talk a little bit about how that process worked and why you guys are so successful.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really just selling a vision. I mean, they hit the portal, and I really think our social media team has done a good job of promoting our vision and what we want to do. And I think social media is a huge aspect of recruiting, you know? So hopefully by the time we actually reach out to a kid on Instagram and talk with them, they've looked through it and they've seen what we're building. And I think, you know, Michigan State's in a really cool position where we've improved a ton, and they can be the guys that really took a program to the next level. And I think that for both of those guys, that vision really, really like, was what brought them here, and they've really bought into it. And obviously you see their results this fall. They're proven, you know, I honestly, I felt like a used car salesman for the last year, because I was selling kids on a vision and I didn't have anything behind it. And now we're starting to put some things on paper with the results we're having. And hopefully we'll have this spring that we can actually point to something and say, hey, this is what we've got, tangible results. And this is what's going to happen, your development. You know, tangible development to point to recruits and players so that, you know, they want to jump on board.
Yeah. And how important was keeping Ozon at home towards that vision? I mean, he's probably, you know, once in a generation type player from that area, and to get him to come to Michigan State, that's a huge win.
Yeah. There's a Ozon, you say once in a generation, about 20, 25 years earlier, there's another once in a generation player that came through East Lansing, played at East Lansing High School, never won a state championship while I did at East Lansing High School. So that's what I hold over him every time I see him. His name was Todd Martin. And Todd Martin, you know, finalist of the US Open, I believe, or Wimbledon, number two or three in the world ATP rankings, ended up going to Northwestern rather than Michigan State. And I think keeping Ozon here was a very, very huge part of what we've been able to do. He really jumped on board and believed in our vision. And again, he's a guy he's not a follower. He's a leader, and he wanted to do something different with his time in college. And it's to this point, I think it's really, really worked out for him.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he's done great, and said a great fall season. He won the Battle of the Bay. You guys did great out there with Ronnie and Ozon, both filing out there, and Ozon making semifinals of ITAs. So that's huge. You guys are one of the few schools that put numbers on the back of your jerseys or shirts or whatever. His number is 72. What does that signify?
I don't know. We've tried to get it out of him, but he's been pretty close to vest on that one. Okay. So, yeah, we gotta dig deep into that one and figure out what it is. But yeah, I don't even know.
There has to be a meaning to it, because I know he's a pretty thoughtful guy, and he's very, you know, global. And I think that there's some meaning behind that. I'm just curious what it is. So maybe I'll have to get him on the podcast and tease it out of him.
Yep.
So. Okay. Well, Scott, have you got a direction you want to go? Because I want to jump into some junior tennis. If you don't,
go.
Yeah. So I'm real curious of your perspective on junior development in the States and also the junior tournaments. I think it's interesting that at no other level in tennis do players play two singles and two doubles in one day. And so then injuries pop up. I'm wondering if you have any opinions on that and how it affects development, because you're sort of towards the end of the development pathway, right? If that pathway were changed, do you think that what you were receiving would be any different?
Yeah, I mean, I find it really interesting, because if you asked our guys, you know, if they played a USTA tournament, like, they wouldn't make it. I mean, you can't at this level, how physical it is, how much they're going, you know, explosive movements from direction to direction. Like, yeah, it wouldn't even be possible for them to play two singles matches, two doubles in a day. And I think it's really taxing mentally on kids. I think a lot of kids get burnt out because they're playing so much in one day. And I always find it interesting, you know, there's this huge argument over, and you see it at KZU every single year. I mean, the backdrop, people are pulling out, they're dropping like flies. And I just look at across the world, you don't see in ITF junior events or even in Tennis Europe junior events, there is no backdrop. Like, you win or you go home. And I think at this point, with how much UTR and WTN are impacting, you know, if a player has a higher UTR than another player in the backdraw, he doesn't want to play, he pulls out, he goes home, maybe just get rid of the backdraw. And that hopefully that solves the amount of matches, because the feeding consolation, I mean, that's a whole nother deal. If you lose first round at KZU, I don't even know the number, but you guys might. It's like 16 matches over the next week that you have to win in order to get to the finals or win the backdraw. It's insane. And two matches a day, every day. And, you know, that's who the Spartans are looking for. The backdraw grinders that are winning two matches a day, you know, get hitting the high stuff, doing it again tomorrow morning, and keep going. So it's really physical. It's really tough. And I think mentally, and even on the parents, I mean, you don't want to be at the facility at 10 p.m. when you're in, let's say you're playing a tournament in Nashville or wherever. Like, you want to go see the sights and make it an enjoyable experience overall for the kids, so he wants to continue to play tournaments.
So what's the solution, though? You know, Scott and I were talking about this the other day. My son, the physicalness, just he normally it's really hard for him to make it to the end of a tournament. But when he plays things like the old school, not Southern Cup, Scott, what's it called? The Zonals, the old school Zonals. Yeah, they were one singles, one doubles a day. And, man, he'd have some of his best results because he plays singles, his doubles, go to sleep, wake up. He's fresh, he's not injured, and then have another good day. And you could grind, and you didn't have to worry about, if I grind out this match and I play it to a third set and I compete, how's that going to affect the match I'm about to play in another hour and a half, right? But what's the solution? Because parents are generally only bringing them during the weekend, and you can't get a whole lot of tournament in the weekend if it's one a day. So what do you think the solution is?
I mean, I really think at this point in time, I do think eliminating backdraw is probably the way to go, especially with, you know, at the highest levels of junior tennis, at least. And I get the need, and maybe it's just one more match. You just get a backdraw match. So you, at least you get two guaranteed matches in a tournament. That's what a lot of college tennis tournaments do. And yeah, it works out really well.
Yeah. First match loser's consolation.
Yeah. Something like that, where it just doesn't drag on and they can stay with it physically. And then also, I think as a parent, you got to manage your kid's schedule, and you got to know where their body's at. As a coach, you got to communicate with them. And then I just think it's not even about tennis, but just getting your kid. And we see it a lot in college. We can tell the difference between the guys who grew up not even lifting weights, but just around the gym. Make them do med ball exercises, band exercises, things that will make them comfortable in the gym. They know what they're doing. They understand basic form for being in the gym. I think that's really, really important as they get older, because, you know, I think in the college atmosphere and professional atmosphere, sometimes that stuff takes precedence over, you know, what you're doing on the court, just because of how physical it is.
Yeah, that's a real good point. I thought, and I hate that while y'all were in Tulsa, we didn't get more time to hang out, get to know each other. You know, the interesting thing about tournaments is you get there and you think, I'm going to do all these things, and then you end up getting all your time sucked up at the tournament. But it was great to get to know you. And it's very clear. I called Scott when it was over. I said, it's very clear why the recruiting's going the way it is, while the team environment you're creating with the guys, they all clearly respect you. They like you. I think y'all are going to have a ton of success. And it's really cool to get some insight into your recruiting process, because Scott and I have talked about this a lot. Every coach that we've ever interacted with that has a lot of success at the college level, it's no different than a successful player. It's just hard work. You're on planes, you're visiting parent players, you're visiting parents, and then you're on the plane for the next one, right? You talked about your frequent flyer. So it's real cool just to hear that theme has continued and Michigan State's in a good place. So, Scott, do you want to dive into the fast speed?
Sure. And I'll just mention, you know, one of the things that I talked to a couple of parents that their children have played some of the slams this year, and they said, Harry's here. Harry's at Wimbledon. Harry's at the US Open and French Open. So it's like, everyone knows you're there. And so your presence is known. And I think that's a good thing because, like I say, I think it's great to have a program that's really, you know, it's turning the corner. You know, it's been very, if you look at your roster maybe a couple of years ago, a lot of Midwest kids, which is great, but now you're getting the Thanoses and some of the more higher level elite US players. And it's good to have programs upsetting the balance and making Ohio State nervous.
I don't know about that yet, but no, I mean, I got to give a shout out to a guy that's really helped me. He was in a situation very similar to me, and I feel like we're a year or two behind them, but Clancy Shields at Arizona, when I was weighing the decision between staying at Illinois or coming to Michigan State as the head coach, you know, he really walked me through, you know, hey, it's a great opportunity at Michigan State, but buckle up because you're going to find a lot of speed bumps. You know, the rich get richer in college tennis in terms of the momentum that they already have. So you're really going to have to manufacture that and, you know, put the sweat equity in. You know, I just look at a program like theirs and they've done a heck of a job, like crazy good job in the short amount of time that he's been there. So, you know, just trying to follow the lead of some guys that have done it before and then also do it our own way. You know, got to be creative and make your mark because that's another thing in recruiting is you got to stick out. I mean, at this point, if you're in the Power Five conference, everybody's offering, you know, full scholarships and, you know, facilities and resources. So why is your school different? So,
right.
Yeah.
Great. All right. So let's get into our fast feed. Robert's got to go here in a few minutes. And so we want to keep this thing quick. But if you could just maybe just give us some quick answers to some questions here and we'll just go that way. But first question is, if you could change anything in college tennis, what would it be?
Cheering. I think fans should be able to talk during the point, get after it. Let's make it like a basketball game.
Love it. Love that answer. All right. So if you invite four tennis coaches to dinner, who would they be? But here's the thing is that the ending has to result in a fight.
Oh man. That's a good question. If I'm inviting coaches to dinner, who would it be?
But
it has to be college coaches.
Yeah, and the ending has to result in a scuffle.
Billy Pate. Goodness gracious. Scott Perlman from Florida. Volunteer assistant, the man.
It's a tough one.
Yeah. I'm thinking here. We'll say Eric Johnson from USC, good friend of mine. Always a good time there. And I mean, I'm going to go Damian Hume from Princeton. And Damian and Billy are going to get in a fight, as they always do, about movies and TV shows. You know, is My Cousin Vinny the best, you know, movie of the, you know, 80s or 90s or whenever it came out? Every single time we're together. Every single time. Damian knows how to get Billy's goat. Every single time.
Excellent. Excellent. All right, so on the road, favorite restaurant, night before a match?
Olive Garden, OG. It's the OG.
The OG.
Give me the chicken Alfredo.
Oh, geez.
I only get it the
carb
night
loading.
The match.
Yeah.
20,000 calories, but it makes me feel warm and fuzzy inside.
Love it. Biggest waste of time on the practice court?
Rallying. I just don't see the point of it. Rallying. I want my guys drilling with a purpose, hitting serves and returns a ton, getting some doubles, reps, volleys. I think hitting up the middle, you know, overrated.
Yeah, makes sense. Best documentary about tennis and non-tennis?
Best documentary non-tennis is going to be Icarus about the doping scandal in Russia. That was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen that one, check it out. And then tennis, I mean, I really liked, I don't know what it was called. I really liked Marty Fish's. I thought the best part of that one was when he was talking about when he played Andy Roddick, and I think it was like the finals of Cincinnati or something like that. And he was like, man, I can serve it wide here, but he knows that's my favorite serve, so I'll serve it T. But he knows that I'm thinking that that's my favorite serve, and I know he knows my game. So I'm actually going to sit in there. He's just going back and forth between, you know, two competitors, and the mental game there was really, really cool.
Yeah, and he just freezes and doesn't go either way, right?
So that's what I would do.
Yeah, I always tell my son,
nice conservative body, sir.
I tell my son all the time. I say, if you're thinking, you're stinking, right? So just get out. Yep. Don't overthink it.
Yep.
All right. So Scott asked that one. What are your non-negotiables? What does it take to get kicked out of practice at Michigan State?
Engagement. I mean, you can be as frustrated as you want, but you better be engaged with the drills we're doing. And you better, I mean, if you need a reason and an understanding of the drills, but if you're, I actually tell my guys, and it's not kicked out for me being mad. It's like, quit wasting my time, quit wasting your time. If you're not engaged, you know, you don't have to be here. You guys are, you know, quasi professional players. You don't want to be here, don't be here. But if you're going to be here, be engaged, have a purpose, and let's get better.
Yeah. Good job. I love it. And last one, best thing about being a Spartan?
Melting Moments ice cream sandwiches at basketball and football games. It's MSU was known as the Michigan Agricultural College, and that's what we were. So, you know, we're big into, there's a lot of cows and dairy, and in our programs with turf and farming are really, really good. We used to be named the Aggies. And we have a really, really good dairy store, and just it's their ice cream sandwiches are to die for. I get one, and in this year during the football games, I've been getting them earlier than I used to. You know, I used to save them for after we get a win, enjoy it. This year, it's about first quarter. I'm having an ice cream sandwich to make myself feel good.
Well, as this has been a fun podcast, as I think about Scott, all the guests we've had. I wish there was a way for us to do like every guest we've had get together at some point. I mean, Imagine putting all those folks in the room together, the tennis knowledge. This has been great, though. Really appreciate you taking the time to do this with us, Harry.
Yeah, Harry, thanks so much. And I'm glad we finally got to do it. And like I say, there's no secret as to why Michigan State is doing so well. You're doing a great job, and look forward to seeing you guys this spring, hopefully. And good luck.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely, guys. Appreciate you having me. And honestly, thank you guys for promoting the game and making it bigger and doing what you guys are doing. I think it's really valuable, and I'm just honored and pumped to have been on the podcast, and hopefully I can get back on soon.
Appreciate it. One quick question before we go. Where will you guys be this spring in some of your non-conference matches?
I mean, some of the big ones are, we're going out to L.A. to play Pepperdine and UCSB. That's going to be in January. We are playing the Blue Gray Cat Classic in Birmingham. And
Robert loves that tournament.
I think the Blue Gray may be the best regular season college tournament I've ever been to.
Sweet. I mean, we've never played it. I've heard great things, and obviously we're honored to even be selected for it. So it's a rich history there. And then we're going to Arizona State to play spring break. Those are probably the three big, you know, trips that we're taking. But our schedule should be out on social media pretty soon here.
So. Okay, look forward to it.
Awesome. Well, go Spartans.
All right, go Sparty.
Yes, sir. Right. Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
All right, thanks, Harry. Take care.